have two speakers today. The first speaker is Dr. Sally Brown. She was born and raised in New York City. She has a BA from Williams College and a master's and PhD from University of Maryland. Currently, Sally is a research associate professor at the University of Washington, and her research has focused on using residuals to reduce metal availability and restore ecosystem function. Our second speaker is Mr. Harry Compton. He has a BS from Stockton College and a master's from University of Pennsylvania. Harry has been with the U.S. EPA for over 20 years, providing technical assistance in the Superfund program. So before I turn over to Sally, let me remind you one more time to put your phones on mute, *6 if you don't have a mute button, and don't put us on hold. Okay, Sally, over to you.
Good morning or afternoon, depending on where you are. I'm the one in the blue sweatshirt and the khakis. You probably figured that one out. Harry's the one with the jeans and the lavender shirt there. Here we are, hard at work, practicing what we preach. This is a session that we've done at a number of RPM and OSC training workshops, and the last workshop was in Los Angeles, and for fun, Harry and I changed this to give it a bit of an LA spin, and I thought that that wouldn't be such a bad thing on a Thursday afternoon either. So the way I want to start here is by showing what you can do much the same way that the network TV. We're out of sync?
Yep. Can everyone please put us on mute, please? Thank you.
Okay. So what I'd like to do to start is go through a couple of the before and afters of what you two can do at a range of different sites. So if you go to slide number 2, and let me also go to slide number 2, you can see one of my favorite sites that Harry and I have worked on. This is a wetland that was used as a tailings repository as in part of the Bunker Hill MPL site. You see the tree stump in the background there, and you see this material on the surface. This is lead and zinc mine tailings. The lead in this material is about 3%, 30,000 parts per million. Zinc is about 15,000 parts per million. This is not a situation that would be considered ecologically beneficial. So here's your before, and what Harry and I did here, and we'll go into detail on this site later on in the presentation, is we used a mixture of wood ash, which is a locally available material in Idaho. There's a lot of lumber and timber industries, and it was very easy to get wood ash. We used wood ash combination with woody debris from the log yards and municipal biosolids compost and sprayed a layer on top of the contaminated tailings. When you work on these sites, I have a wide array of silverware from the different Superfund sites we've worked on. And this was the first case where we found a dinosaur remnant. You can see the dinosaur on top of that stump. And then if you go one more slide, you can see in 2005, See It Shine. Tree stump still in the background, but that tree stump looks a whole lot better, in my opinion, with the reeds and the grasses and the ducks and the river otters and the fish in the wetland that's now there. This was taken last summer, and I was there this summer, and it still is looking good. So I can't ask you because you have to have your phones on mute, but I would feel pretty comfortable that this is a pretty extreme makeover. Makeover number 2, Jasper County, Missouri. If you go to Joplin, if you ever have a chance to go to Joplin, just email me or Harry. We can give you lots of dining recommendations. Have spent many, many days in Joplin, Missouri. Joplin is part of the Tri-State Mining Region, a big deposit of lead and zinc that was mined heavily in the beginning part of the 1900s. And a lot of the mining there was done as mom-and-pop operations. And so you have counties like Jasper County, which has acre after acre of mine wastes. There's no ocean in sight here. It may look like a beach in the winter, but it's really just mine wastes on the surface here. And here's the before shot. You go to the next slide, and I'm loading it right now. And here we use agricultural limestone from a nearby lime quarry. This is slide number 6. mixed with biosolids from Springfield, Missouri, tilled it into the surface, and here is Mike from Springfield tilling it in, and you go to the next side, and there's a former student who is 6 feet tall, and it doesn't quite look like a beach there anymore. It looks pretty nice as the slide said. For our last case, or our last example of extreme makeover before we start getting into the details here, Leadville, Colorado, where it does snow, but what you're seeing on the surface here, this is slide number 8, is not snow, but metal salts. This was an area that was mined very high pyrite ores, which means that once they're exposed to oxygen, they turn right into sulfuric acid. And when this was mined, again, early 1900s, mining wasn't nearly as efficient as it is today, and there were no regulations in place. So a lot of the mine tailings went right down the river and got deposited. This is an alluvial tailings deposit. The zinc salts here, the stuff that looks like snow, is about 90,000 parts per million zinc. Nothing had grown on these fields for 80 years. We came, along with the help of Denver Metro, and using lime kill dust, sugar beet lime, another byproduct from Greeley, Colorado, municipal biosolids, biosolids compost, and put a very thick layer of amendments on the surface here. Here you can see Chuck Henry, who's worked on these sites, and Kevin, a grad student from Colorado State, using snowshoes in a way that no one ever intended them to be used, walking through the site just after we had spread the mix of biosolids and limestone there. And go to slide number 9. Here it was last summer. It's a pleasure on this site, and you'll hear a lot more about this site later, to get stuff growing on a guy's ranch who in his life of 75 years had never seen things growing on certain numbers of these fields. Now, one thing that we can do here with the internet, because you can ask questions, if you want to cast a ballot as to which makeover is your favorite, we can pretend we're on American Idol, not quite necessarily what you hadn't expected, but if you want to do that, that'd be kind of fun. So go ahead and we can get a survey or get a count at the end. But this is my way to show you what you can do. If you go to the next slide, green remediation, Harry will take over for a while. But these are really tough sites that we've worked on, and the turnaround that we've seen is really impressive, and it's really cost-effective and pretty easy to do. So, Harry?
Thank you, Sally. Ellen did a great job introducing us, but Ellen Rubin also plays a pretty significant role helping us out and with the organizational stuff and putting together fact sheets as well. So Ellen is a big part of this whole process as well. As I said before, I'm an engineer with the Environmental Protection Agency response team, so we work in all 10 regions of EPA, and Sally Brown, who originally first met her with she was with USDA, and then went to University of Washington. But the point is that we originally started an agreement way back when, an IAG in the government terms, of trying to solicit USDA assistance at some of these really large mining sites. And Rufus Cheney, her mentor, and several other really good scientists have been fantastic about being very helpful about coming out to the sites and coming up with some of these tailor-made remedies. So I want to make sure I give credit to all the folks that actually played a role here. All right, going to slide number... We're on the slide number 12, I think.
Okay.
And the point of this slide is that we and ERT help out the site managers in the Superfund program, well, both the RPMs and the OSCs. And many years ago, we pretty much did dig and haul. We went to a site, we dug up all the contamination, and we put it somewhere else. At this particular site, we dug up, we being EPA, almost a quarter of a million cubic yards of material, and it's still sitting there in a pile because even though that was pretty much standard procedure and there were plans in place to treat it, this is pentachlorophenol and the creosote contaminated soil. I mean, if the cost of actually treating all this dirt is just phenomenal. And the point is, they're just, with EPA's financial constraints and Superfund, even with all of Superfund, we just can't keep digging, hauling all these sites, especially these mega sites, these large mining sites, abandoned steel mills. These are sites that are square miles in size. So we have to come up with another way to reduce risk, some publicly acceptable, cost-effective way of reducing risk. And if we're good, then maybe we can even reestablish a functioning soil and establish some vegetation and get a vegetative buffer as well as immobilize the metals. So that's our goal. So we pretty much don't do this anymore. We pretty much don't have the big dig and haul kind of projects within Superfund. We're looking for more cost-effective alternatives. We move to slide number 13. Okay, within Superfund, not that long ago, we had an AA for Oswer. Her name was Marianne Lamont-Haringo, and she established six priorities, and here we have three of them. And I thought it was wonderful because three of these priorities fit very well with exactly what we're trying to accomplish. We're revitalizing these sites one way or another. We're getting them back into some kind of reuse, which in Superfund is pretty important for us because now it's a GPRA, or a government accounting measure. It's a way of Congress actually measures our success at sites and getting sites back into reuse. Now, most people know it as box stores like Home Depots and Walmarts and those kinds of things, but it's also green reuse. They count as well. So there's a big push to get these sites back into reuse one way or another. And recycling. We're taking waste materials or residuals from other industries, other utilities, public utilities, and combining them with waste materials or tailings material, in this case, on these case studies, to get them basically get them into some productive, beneficial reuse. So we're recycling residuals, mixing it with the tailings. And the One Cleanup Program. One of Marianne Lamont-Haringo's big pushes was to try and solidify the cleanup goals of all the cleanup programs, RECRA, Superfund, Brownfield, so that there's more consistency across the board. And one of the things that you'll hear us talk about are actually performance measures, and there's a push now to try and get more consistent performance measures after we apply or implement these in situ cleanup programs, looking for cleanup goals other than total constituent contamination. We're going to be looking at other ways of measuring success at these sites. Okay, slide number 14. Okay, this is where we jump back to Sally. Sally, I think, picks it up from here.
Okay. The sites that we're going to talk today about are mine sites, and you'll see a lot of the problems that you have at mine sites, at brownfield sites, urban contaminated sites, sites that have had a use other than native ecosystem. At the mine sites, you're going to have all of these problems. At other sites that you'll work on, you may have just a couple of these problems if you're lucky, but this is a pretty much as bad as you can get. With the mine sites, you've taken rocks that were buried 1,000 feet underground, ground them up, put them on the soil surface, and then you're trying to grow plants in them. Often, these rocks from down below have a lot of contaminants in them. They may generate acidity when they come to the surface. They don't have that nice crumbly feel that good soil has. They may, because of all the minerals that are coming into solution as you expose them to oxygen and rainfall, have big salt contents. All these things make it very, very tough for any type of plant to grow. So when you're coming into a site like this, you have to look at it not just from the perspective of the zinc level or the level of TCE. You have to look at a site, what is preventing an ecosystem from coming back here, what's preventing plant growth. And here you have to use some of the stuff that you know from your own gardens, if you have a garden, or some basic knowledge of what a plant needs or what an ecosystem needs, and take that into account as you develop a remedy. So if we go to number 15, what we're coming into at these sites, the goals that we're going into is no longer is dig and haul an option, as Harry said. So as opposed to digging and hauling the contaminant away, we have to come up with a solution where you can leave the contaminant in place but take away the hazards associated with the contaminant. In-situ treatment is a way to say this in EPA lingo. Another way to say this is to reduce the bioavailability of the contaminant. So it's basically taking all that cash that you have in your wallet and putting 98% of it in a long-term deposit vault where nobody has any access to it. So you want to take the contaminants in place. If they're organic, there's a potential to break them down, have them mineralized. If they're a metal contaminant, what you want to do is to change the form of the contaminant so that they're not bioavailability. And different in-situ amendments or treatments can do this. Now, to get back to the host of problems on the previous slide, you want to do that, and you also need to build a new soil or rebuild your existing soil. And a way to test that you've done a good job on that is to see if you can have the functions that a soil normally does for you taking place at a restored site. So can plants grow without having to reseed every year and refertilize every year? Are you going to be able to maintain soil fertility? And ideally, what a goal can be, and you're seeing more emphasis for this as the value of open space and native ecosystems is getting recognized, if you can get a native plant ecosystem established on one of these sites. Now, next slide, please. I can click that myself here, and I just did. Anyway, the approach we've taken is to try and do all these things using different residuals. These are waste materials. Why are we putting such a big emphasis on using waste? And if you look in all those green letters, and green is environmentally friendly, so you get the choice of color there. Reasons to do this include when you're working on a very large scale site or even a smaller site, moving soil, burning soil, a lot of the traditional remedies can be very, very, very costly, prohibitively costly, and that can prevent you from doing anything at all and leaving contaminants in place. If you use residuals, often there's little to no cost associated with the residual. Transport can be your only cost, and in some cases even that is subsidized. So it's a potential to use a material that can be valuable at your site at a very low cost. In addition to that, you're doing what EPA's goals are, as Harry said, using waste for a better use. You can do this, not only can you do this on 1 acre, you can do this on a square mile site and still be okay financially. And the other thing that's nice is a lot of the people that generate these residuals have a long history of experience of how to use them. So you can come in, and in working with a company that or a municipality that generates the residuals, you can tap into their knowledge on how to apply these things. You can often tap into their equipment. So in some cases, using residuals can be like one-stop shopping. Okay, if you go to the next slide. One thing that we've tried to do now at the sessions that we teach is get some hands-on stuff going. So bringing in different residuals, having you feel them, smell them. Now, it's a wonderful thing that we can do a webcast like this, but it's not quite up to the live studio demonstration capability. So I've taken one of the things that we started doing and put it into slide form, so you have to imagine with me here. One thing that you get when you add residuals is improved soil physical properties. And those can be really important. The key to improving the soil physical stuff is organic matter. And so what we do in the session now is take columns, and here, it's a remote, almost live. Here I used sand, and in a lot of cases the stuff that you're left with on the surface has no organic matter content in it at all. It can be sand, it can be clay, and if you have sand, the water will just pour through that, just like water when the wave hits on a beach. And so it may rain on a Tuesday, and by Thursday you have plants that are just in desperate need of water because there's no water holding capacity. So what we did here, and this is vermicompost, and I practice what I preach at home here. This is vermicompost that we've made. We can, if you come over, we can give you a wide range of compost options. So here we just use the vermicompost for this. This is worm compost from food waste, and you can see that in the first picture, sand dumped on top in the second picture, and then the two mixed together. And I have somebody at my door here that I am not letting in, I'm sorry. Anyway, then we pick these, pack them into columns. One column is only sand, and that's the column that's on my left, or I don't know, left is the right word, sand. You can see the D there. And then the column on the right has the sand mixed with the compost. And compost here has changed two things. You can see that the water has gone much farther down, or not much farther in this case, but further down in the sand column than the sand with the compost here. And that's in slide 19. If you go to slide number 20, and it's slowly loading here, one of the things that we've also done by adding the compost is decrease the bulk density of soil. So one of the reasons you didn't see a more dramatic change in slowing of water movement was because it was, the compost is so fluffy, there were huge holes because I didn't pack it down enough. So if you have a soil that's very, very heavy, like a very high clay material, you add organic matter to it, it'll make it much less dense. It'll make it easier for plant roots to grow, and adding the organic matter will also help the soil hold on to the water. So you get a multitude of benefits by using organic matter as one of your amendments. And that concludes our hands-on demonstration, so to speak. And I hope that was helpful. If you go to the next slide, Harry, do you want to do this one? Harry, are you there?
Yes. Yeah, okay. The steps in design?
Mm-hmm. Just.
Sure. I mean, for those of you that work on any of these sites at all, you know that it's pretty critical to do a thorough site history to figure out how the contamination got there and where it is and extent of contamination, and being careful with sampling and analysis. I mean, those are straightforward, and this isn't a talk about how to do an extended contamination study. But the important things are for this particular approach is understanding the contaminants. They all have a different, or a fate in transport that we need to be aware of. Arsenic behaves a lot differently than lead, and lead affects things differently than zinc and those kinds of things. So just knowing, having a good knowledge of all the contaminants that are there, the soil physical conditions. What is the soil like? Is it a coal mining kind of site that we're looking at, where we really just have infertility and not much toxicity? Or is it a mining site thing where there's terrible, where it's tailings and it's poor physical conditions, no soil structure whatsoever, low organic matter, and those kinds of things? And climate. Climate is critical as well. What's the environmental niche that we're shooting for here to try and restore or revitalize the environment to bring it back to some kind of beneficial reuse? You'll see the different sites that we look at. Leadville is a heck of a lot different than Jasper and Bunker Hill. So the next step would be to look at the... Oh.
What was that?
I don't know. Inventory of available materials. You know, what can we bring to bear? What are some residuals out there that we can bring to bear on these specific contaminants at the site, given these soil physical conditions and the climate? Do we want sugar beet lime? Do we want biosolids? Do we want compost? Do we want manure? pulp and paper sludge, there's a plethora of different residuals that could be used, but the important thing is to tailor the right mix and identify those appropriate mixtures. Sally, you want to add something to that?
I think that we can go to the next slide, because
okay.
The specific examples I can...
Okay, back to you.
I think we're going to stop here now for question and answer, sir.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
Okay. if anybody has any questions, please unmute your phone and feel free to ask them. I can start with some of the questions that were written in, and if you'd like, this is a good time to write in your questions.
Did you get any votes on the best site yet?
I did. There was a tie between Bunker Hill and Missouri.
Okay.
If you can make the music from that show, but I don't know it. I've never even seen it. So the first question was from Bob in Montana. He wanted to know, were the amendments incorporated into the lead tailings, or were they just sprayed on the surface?
It depends on the site. At Bunker Hill, with the wetland, we put stuff on the surface because we were trying to make a cap. And in other cases, another example is Palmerton, Pennsylvania, where there were pretty steeply sloping hillsides. In that case, you want to do a surface application because that's about all you can do. In other sites, what we've done is incorporated material directly into the contaminated tailings on the surface. So with the pictures in Leadville as well as in Jasper County, in both those cases, materials, the residuals were incorporated directly into the surface tailings. So it's a site-by-site thing. You're generally better off incorporating. If your material is so nasty, you may want to do a surface application and build a living cap.
Okay, thanks. A second question, also from Bob at Montana, was can you discuss cost per acre?
Sure. Actually, one thing here, and this is a good plug, one of the things that Ellen has been instrumental in doing along with Harry is, or we just in August had a workshop on use of amendments, and the goal of that workshop was to produce a very user-friendly web-based guide to how to do this, and that will have extensive details on costs and how much these projects cost. In Leadville, we worked with Denver Metro, who generates the biosolids, and they provided all the biosolids we needed for the project for, I think it was the first 10 or 12 acres, was it, Harry?
Yes.
But
the cost of the biosolids weren't expensive. It was trucking them.
Yeah, so we paid, the cost was there, was trucking the materials, and they also provided application equipment and did application of the residual. So that was $25,000, I believe, for their end. In other cases, in Palmerton, they got a tipping fee for taking the residuals. There they use biosolids and coal fly ash. So you have one of the deals with this type of approach, if you can identify a local residual, again, transport will be your only cost, or a portion of that transport can be subsidized. If you have a site in California, they have a lot of biosolids, so that will greatly reduce your costs. If that helps as an answer.
Carrie. Sally.
It's terrible, Carrie. Carrie is Harry's wife. So I stand insulted, corrected, humbled, whatever.
Already even slipped there. Hey, you might want to point out that the producers of these residuals, the utilities or CAFOs or whatever they are, usually have to pay someone to dispose of this material. So more often than not, they're happy to find another outlet
mm-hmm.
and not have to pay for disposal.
Yeah. Yep. This is very true.
Okay. I'll ask one more question here online, and then we'll go to the phone lines. Do you ever try to measure the reestablished microorganism component of the soil to see how close it comes to a native soil?
As a matter of fact, if you stay online, you'll get data on that. And then more than the data that we'll present here, I have a grad student now who's looking at microbial communities associated with native plants in uncontaminated sites and restored sites to see what kind of soil microbes you have, what their functions are in the restored sites versus native uncontaminated sites. So in a few years, I'll have an even better answer to that question.
Great. Thank you. How about on the phone lines? Does anybody have a question?
This is Todd Bragdon with CDM. I had a question for Harry regarding the regulatory use of this. And that is, you know, I'm used to more surplus sites where we have to put a record equivalent clay cap or plastic or design an ET cap to go over long-term storage of contamination. What's the difference between those type of requirements and in the projects that you're working on?
These are considered in-situ remedies versus landfills. And you're talking mostly to landfill kind of operations, right? If I understand you correctly?
Well, what I'm talking about is, you know, my understanding is if you're going to have a repository for a long term, you've got to minimize infiltration of water through that repository. And what just as a surface glance here, it seems to me that you still are maintaining contaminated material in place, but you're providing, you know, a restored cover, if you will, for these things. And I'm just curious, why aren't there similar requirements to reduce infiltration and other requirements that are typically in place for long-term repositories of contaminated material? Because from understanding the project correctly, you have a tailings pond. You're not really treating all the waste in the tailings pond. You're essentially putting a limited cover on top. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious why that cover does not have the same type of requirements as other CERCLA sites where you have a waste contained in place. Is it because of the mining waste element of it that allows you not to put a record cover, you know, a plastic or a clay cover on top?
Well, I think what's happening, well, this is really considered an in-situ remedy, and it really differs from site to site. And I understand what you're getting at, but for the wetlands specifically, the problem there were, and Sally will probably get to that in a little bit, but it's the fact that the waterfowl were actually dabbling in the sediments and ingesting the material, so we needed to create a buffer. A physical barrier, so the physical barrier, and I don't want to steal Sally's thunder, but she'll talk about that. So the goal was a little bit different. There was already a rod in place at that site that said the 2-foot water cap was sufficient to contain that material in place. And as Sally, as you'll find out, the 2-foot water cap was not sufficient. And so we had to go in and basically alter that a bit to make it work. At the Leadville site, we're actually immobilizing the metals. We are reducing infiltration, and we're actually treating the material in place, so it's more of an in-situ remedy. So I understand where you're coming from, and I'm not sure I can get to the subtle nuances, but it really is a site-by-site mission as we go along.
One thing that I've gathered from Harry is that this is a new approach within the agency, and there's growing support for this type of approach at certain sites. It's not going to be an answer for all sites. It's going to be more of an acceptable answer when ecosystem endpoints rather than human health are your primary drivers. So, as Harry said, it's a site-by-site, and it may be that for some of the sites you mentioned, this type of approach would be acceptable within the agency. Is that correct, Harry?
Yes.
And I also, this is Ellen Rubin. I also think that when you're, it's different to contain a site with a cap to remediate the site to make it not bioavailable or mobile.
Mm-hmm.
Those are two main differences also between the capping and the amendments.
Oh. Yeah, that's not a subtle difference too, Ellen. That's an important point.
Yep.
Thank you.
Sure. Do you have any other questions on the phone line?
Yes, hello?
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I had a question about in the use of biosolids. Is the component in the biosolids a phosphate or a phosphorus compound that's being used to immobilize the heavy metals? And if so, are there any studies that show the effectiveness of the minerals that are formed with regard to potential chronic exposure, specifically with lead phosphate and deposition within bones of either humans or animals as it competes against calcium phosphate deposition?
Yep.
And also with regard to zinc, zinc phosphate, I believe, is regulated under FIFRA as a rodenticide. So are there any long-term studies being done to show what those, what the potential chronic effects might be?
Let me answer that. The biosolids do have relatively high phosphorus concentrations. You'll have somewhere between 2% and 5% phosphorus is a normal concentration in a biosolid system. The kind of binding that we see is not, I've done a lot with the different lead phosphorus systems, and what we see more in the biosolids is a combination of inorganic and organic binding. So the metals in the biosolid systems are binding not necessarily with the P or not with the P alone, but also with things like iron and manganese in the biosolids. There's work that's been done on this coming out of EPA Cincinnati, and I just have been doing stuff with this with high iron biosolids compost, looking at lead and arsenic speciation in treated soils. So it's not necessarily a phosphorus complex. It's likely an iron lead or an iron arsenic complex. We've tested these remediated sites with feeding studies, in vivo feeding studies using rats, also with the lab PBET in vitro extract, and seen reductions in metal availability. So when an animal will eat this remediated soil, the lead doesn't get absorbed into their system. So you can measure changes in bone lead and changes in blood lead, and you see a reduction in availability and a reduction in absorption compared to the unamended soil. The other thing here is that at a number of these sites, Mark Springer, an ecotoxicologist that works with Harry, has done small mammal trapping, and in Jasper County did kidney and liver analysis and saw basically normal, first of all, the process of trapping the animals at the sites was very easy because their population comes right back. And in one of the talks I've given on these sites, I've done a section, Name That Scat, because you see such an animal presence, evidence of animal presence. With the pathology on the kidneys and the livers, you see normal function. So on a number of levels, this has been tested. It's not necessarily the phosphorus that's doing the binding. There are other components as well. And it seems to be safe for the animals that come back and inhabit the sites.
Thank you. Why don't we have one last question on the phone line, if there is one, before we continue on.
Yeah, actually, I'd like to follow up on that. What about the studies on the zinc phosphate with regard to bioavailability and it being regulated under FIFRA? Have you seen any...
We haven't seen any excess. One of the things with the zinc is the zinc tends to be more harmful to plants than to the animals. If you look in the scientific literature on a range of contaminated sites, the animals and the sites tend to have body zinc levels that are comparable to those in uncontaminated sites. The metals that will accumulate are lead and cadmium. And so zinc, what we measure primarily is zinc concentration in plant tissue. I don't know why zinc phosphates are regulated, but in ecosystems and the studies on contaminated ecosystems, body burden of zinc, unless you have certain cases where you have very extreme examples. Leadville was one of those cases where you had horses grazing and having health problems because of ingesting soil. This was before we went in, and it was a zinc-induced copper deficiency. But primarily zinc, the target for zinc is going to be plants. And there you have that answer.
All right. Thanks, Sally. We should, let's end the question session for now and move on. We'll have another question session in about 20 or 30 slides.
Okay, so now we should be up to 22. Back to that extreme makeover theme, behind the scenes, step-by-step look and how-to guide. Harry and I are going to talk about two of the sites, the wetland in Idaho and then the alluvial tailings in Colorado, and give information on how the amendments were applied and more actual data on the ecosystem function as a result of the amendment application. And to make me happy anyway, more pretty pictures. Okay, so if you go to number 23, we're going to start with a swamp in Idaho. And as Harry had said earlier, here human health has not been the focus. The focus here has been the wildlife. You had range of migratory swans and other waterfowl, and normally when a bird dies of acute lead poisoning, it's because somebody shot the bird. In this case, you're supposed to laugh at that. I can't hear if you're laughing or not because you have the mute buttons on, but in this case, you had the birds that were dying of acute lead poisoning, and it wasn't because anybody shot them. It was because they ended up eating a whole lot of sediment while they were diving down to eat roots and tubers, and you were finding birds that had lead poisoning in these areas. And here are some of the metal concentrations. In this particular deposit, tailings deposit, arsenic was relatively low. Arsenic will be an associated metal with lead. In many cases, you'll see co-contamination. Okay, go to the next slide. And here you can see the compost and wood ash cap on the surface. This is within 15 minutes after we put the stuff down. We did it with a blower, and you'll see some pictures of that. There were bets going on in Region 10 about how quickly the compost would float away. And, in fact, you can see some at the edge of the picture still floating. The compost material sank pretty quickly once it got wet. And on the one side of the picture, on the right side of the picture, to gain access here, we built a road using woody waste material, so it was a road that we could leave in place when we were done. Mess it up a little bit, but leave it in place, and that left some irregular habitat, which was really nice for the animals coming back in. It was a great way to access the swamp, access the tailings without sinking, and it was nice because you could leave it in. Here, if you go to number 25, the justification for what we were doing, it was like a skin graft, you could say. By putting this cap over the tailings, we were making not an impermeable barrier, but a very practical barrier. It's a very fertile soil horizon that we've made. It's high enough organic that it's going to look like a wetland soil. This is where a plant's going to go, because it can get good stability, it can get nutrients. There's no reason for a plant to go below this into the tailings when you've made a nice environment for it. So the birds that are diving to eat the plant roots will be eating compost instead of the contaminated tailings. The other thing we were trying to do here is bring function back to the wetland. If you've stuck a shovel into a functioning wetland, you get that rotten egg smell. That's indications that it's a functioning microbial community in the wetland. You get sulfur being reduced. That's hydrogen sulfide that makes that stink. If you have sulfur being reduced, you have a good chance of taking the lead that's in that system and reprecipitating it as galena, which is lead sulfide. Galena has a really low solubility product, and there have been pig feedings where they fed pigs galena and a range of other types of lead, like lead carbonates and lead oxides. And John Drexler in Region 10 did this. Not Region 10, in Denver did this. And the absorption of the body of galena is almost zero. So if we get to make galena here, we basically take the thread of the lead in the submerged tailings and reduce it even further. Okay, so how did we do this? What was our recipe here? We used biosolids compost. Compost is going to be a stable organic matter. If you take fresh manure or fresh biosolids and put it into a wetland, you're going to turn that wetland bright green, get rid of all the dissolved oxygen because you just put a very, very delicious food source for all the things that live in the wetland. Compost, you can add the organic matter in a stable form. Wood ash and lime, we got pH adjustment from that, and we also got a mineral soil, a nice basis to build the mineral soil. And the wood waste and the other carbon-rich residuals that could be used here, it was our road-building material, but it was also our insurance that we wouldn't have eutrophication in the system. So in a wetland like this, if you're going to use a conventional, or one thing that's becoming more conventional is adding phosphorus to precipitate out pyromorphite, the levels of phosphorus that you need to use, 1%, will turn a system like that bright green and kill all the fish very quickly. So this was an option. And if you go now to the next slide, you can see the different components of our mix and what they look like. The compost, back before I had bangs, wood ash, which looks like a dark sandy material, and the wood waste material. Okay, and this was the basis for our mixture. And then you get on 28, you get a map of how we treated this. Some of the stuff, you can see the brown line there was a log yard road that we built. Some of the material we were able to apply with a dozer. Some we did a throw spreader. And then the last bit that we couldn't reach, we used a blower to blow the compost mix into. And you can see it happening on number 29. Here's the dozer. And this is a very unsophisticated, very quick, cheap, and easy way to spread large amounts of amendments. You can see the cloud going up as the compost goes on top. 29. Unfortunately, this was our goal was to do this for as much of the wetland as possible. The wetland had started raining and the water started filling up in the wetland, and this became not a very reliable option very quickly. And then we went to the blower system. This is a blower that's mounted on a truck that has huge four-wheel drive tires, so you can get on a lot of very difficult terrain with this. It's just a standard manure spreader, a sidecast thrower. If you're using a wet residual like a manure or a biosolids, you can get a throw distance here of over 150 feet. The compost was drier, it was fluffier, so our throw distance was less than 100 feet. You can see that tree stump in this picture that was in the very beginning, beautiful makeover shots, and here it is before it got covered with the compost and ash mixture. So with these residuals, there are a range of different ways you can apply them. That's sort of the point of going through these slides. For the last option here, for the things that we couldn't get to from the road that we had built, compost is often blown into sites, and here was a blower truck that Harry was at the site for this. I wasn't at the site for this portion of it, but you can blow the material into place. So these are just a range of things you can use, and here are nice before and afters on page 30, slide 32. Vegetation was not sparse when we were done here. And one thing I should add is this was also not a seeded area. We didn't come back and seed. There was an existing wetland nearby, and that served as a seed source. The birds and the animals that lived in that wetland, walking through this one and windblown seed, we, within a year, had a full cover. And if people here did Steve Handel's seminar, heard a lot there on islands of vegetation and how they can be very, very useful. This is an example of that. Now, what did it look like from a science basis? It looked real pretty in the picture. Plant lead. If you go to slide number 33, two of the species that are native to this type of site, and you look at the plant uptake of lead, this is one indication of have we reduced the availability of the metal. And the difference between the unamended soil, we barely could find a plant growing in the amended soil, you have orders of magnitude lower plant lead concentrations. So it's one indication that we have reduced the availability. We did a number of other tests here. Small minnow tests were done by Mark Springer. And then last summer, we collected cores from the swamp and did analysis, the physiologically based extraction test, and then we also used X-ray absorption spectroscopy to see if the lead in the underlying sediment had reverted back to galena. You can see the core here, the sediment below the compost, and this is compost that was applied in 97 or 98, and these are cores in 2005, so we've had a pretty stable compost layer on the surface. And in the interior of the core here at the lower level, you can see some oxidized material at the very low level with the red rust, and we also sampled directly below the compost layer. And what we've seen is that opposite from what you'd expect, this is slide number 35. This is some of the X-ray absorption results. This was done by Kirk Shekel from EPA Cincinnati. At the interface, where you have more oxygen and you expect to have less galena, you have more galena than you do further down. So it would seem that our initial goal to make it a reducing environment and reprecipitate that galena has been somewhat effective here. Okay. I'm done with the swamp. We can take questions on that later. There's more information on that. And now the other site we wanted to talk about was Leadville, so number 36. And, Harry, do you want to start on Leadville?
Yes. I just want to double-check with Ellen. Is this a question and answer time, or we go through this first?
No, let's go through this first.
Okay. Okay, Leadville, Colorado, one of my favorite sites. It's I have to characterize the area because it's a pretty unique environment. It's Leadville is the highest elevation incorporated town in North America at 10,200 feet. The site is actually fluvial tailings from the California Gulch mining site that were deposited along an 11-mile stretch of the Upper Arkansas River. And there these deposits along the 11-mile stretch were anywhere from about a half acre to 2 acres in size, more or less, of these tailings. These tailings were rich in metals, lead, zinc, and cadmium for the most part. And as you can see in the slide, and Sally has already discussed earlier, that's not snow, even though Leadville gets plenty of snow. Those are metal salts that have been wicked to the surface because this is extremely arid area. Leadville only gets about 16 to 17 inches of precipitation a year, and the growing season is 60 days. So this is would be considered a fairly extreme environmental niche to grow anything, let alone trying to do an in situ revitalization to get these soils back in, or these tailings back into some kind of beneficial use. All right, let's move on to the next slide, slide number 37. All right, so here we are. The historical mine tailings were washed down from the old mining site. It's been going on from anywhere from 80 to 100 years. The deposits were extremely toxic to the vegetation. There were willow trees that hadn't decayed or rotted because there was no bacteria or fungus to do that had been there for years and years. One of the local landowners there, Doc Smith, said he'd basically been battling the mining companies his entire life, trying to get them to do something there on this property. Because the soils had no structure, if you remember at the beginning of the talk, we talked about the soil structure and the properties, these tailings are almost like sand in consistency, and so they would slough off and fall into the river with the episodic ups and downs of the Upper Arkansas. The river is controlled by a reservoir, and so it being a western area, western water rights, there were certain high demand areas, so you would get some fairly good fluctuations in the river levels there, which didn't help the tailings right next there. They would slough off and contribute to fish kills when the large chunks would slough off into the river. Okay, slide 38. All right, so the risks. The re-entrainment of the tailings. This was voiced over and over again from the stakeholder groups that we were listening to out there in Leadville. There was a core group that was
expressed concern that even if we tried this innovative technology and we supposedly immobilized the lead and other metals with biosolids and lime and so on, how could we show that if there was another episodic or catastrophic release of these tailings that were treated into the river, how do they know they wouldn't resolubilize and just have more fish kills and have more problems? And as well as the stabilized tailings, you know, we had to delineate the risk to the upland ecosystem, you know, the food chain, and evaluate the food chain ecosystem. And that, with the help of Dr. Springer, he helped us do that. Okay, so the soil system. As it existed when we went out there, so these are pyritic tailings. They're iron sulfide. So as Sally mentioned before, when they oxidize, you get sulfuric acid being generated. And so these soils were fairly low in pH, highly acidic. The fluctuating water table from the river and from the insufficient rainfall, the metals would become extremely soluble by oxidation and either wick to the surface because it's an area where evaporation exceeds precipitation, so you get this metal wicking to the surface. And if they did get a sufficient amount of contact with water, either from the river, then they would become soluble and go into the groundwater. And so you get the salt crusting on the surface. So what happens when we add lime and amendment?
This is number 40 now.
Oh, I'm sorry. Number 40. Thank you. So we're going to increase the subsoil surface pH by looking at acid neutralization or figuring out how much lime we need to add to compensate for the potential and actual acidity, increase the organic matter to reduce that wicking effect, as Sally did with the soil cores, to try and get an improved water holding capacity in the soil so the precipitation that was there didn't just run straight through and into the groundwater. Precipitate those metals using the iron and manganese oxides that are in biosolids to make them a more insoluble precipitate so they will become less mobile in the environment and less bioavailable. Increase the microbial activity as soil functionality, basically, so we can increase the potential for reduction in sulfide precipitation. And these two mechanisms, as Sally already discussed before, actually reduce the metal availability. Okay, on to slide 41. So we have Denver Metro Wastewater Treatment Authority. We're happy to donate the material. However, we had to pay for trucking. And the folks, the union truck drivers that delivered the material to the site weren't used to driving up into the mountains. They were used to driving east of the flatlands, the farmlands around Denver. And that was a little bit of a struggle to get them driving over mountain passes with lots of biosolids. But anyway, the application rate, now correct me if I'm wrong, Sally, but it was 250 wet tons per acre of biosolids. This is a Class B biosolids cake that was delivered to the site. And we used agricultural lime at about 100 tons per acre.
And we should have, in later years, they used more reactive limestone. So if the finer limestone or a lime kiln dust or the sugar beet lime was more reactive for the very acidic tailings.
Right. Okay.
If you go to number 42, you can see the mixture of the lime and the biosolids.
Yes. We mix the lime and the coconut.
So you don't drink it all up.
So we're mixing the lime and the biosolids just using a big loader. It wasn't pretty, but it was effective. And if you can imagine, this thick biosolids cake was like a thick black pudding when it was plopped onto the ground. It was an interesting material to work with. All right, slide 43. So we used uh, this, that, uh,
on the upper picture on the right-hand side, that piece of equipment is called a pterygator, and on the lower right side. And so we just filled the mixture of biosolids and lime, and it's just like an industrial spreader, as it were. And so this being the first real large site we tried to incorporate this material, it was we went through some growing pains because it ended up being about a foot thick of sludge on these tailings deposits, and we wanted to incorporate it, so we ended up in the end using a tooth ripper, and that didn't provide perfect homogeneity, but it did it did a pretty good job. We experimented with, in the early stages, we used too light of a bulldozer, and the dozer just skated right across this thick sludge like it was on ice, a lake of ice. So anyway, that's how we ended up applying the material, mixing and applying and incorporating the material. And on to slide, what number are we on?
44.
Waiting for it to... And here you can see Sally outstanding in the field. So we have a before picture there with the tailing sloughing off, the poor soil structure being sloughed off, and Sally outstanding in the field. Now I should mention, give credit to the OSC there, Mike Zimmerman, actually, before we incorporated the amendments at a lot of these deposits, and we ended up doing about 40 acres altogether. He reinforced all those embankments there with both hard and soft structures using riprap, large riprap, and willow logs and root wattles and those kinds of things to stabilize the bank before he incorporated the amendment. So we wouldn't lose our treatment back into the river if there was an unexpected raising of the river. This is... Just the picture in the lower right, you can see, is just a couple of years later. We had extremely lush and rich growth. We had for Leadville, they actually got a fair amount of rainfall the year or two after we applied the amendment. However, the following 3 years or so, it was a drought, and it just looked terrible. But the whole area looked terrible because of the drought. And bear in mind, they only get 17 inches of rain or precipitation total there anyway.
And you were there last summer.
And I was there last summer, and it was it looked great. We actually had folks from Montana State University, Dennis Newman, who came out and took a look as an outside expert and said, this looks great. This is a good thing that you're doing. So it kind of validated a lot of the work that we were doing for out there. It kind of helped us out politically. Now, next slide, number 45, we have a special treat today, and today only. Dr. Mark Springer.
Is he there?
Is here.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to present. He's going to talk about a couple of the eco aspects that he was involved with. So just give us a second to switch chairs here.
This is so exciting.
This is the danger of being in the office. You never know what's going to happen to you. How do I scroll down?
Just click on me.
Why don't we take a question while they're getting situated here? One of the questions I have, Sally, is the next question list is, does soil remediation only affect surficial soils? Is groundwater still contaminated, and have contaminants been immobilized?
In the case of metals, most of the metals that you're going to be, or a lot of the metals that you're working with will be pretty immobile in a soil surface. Arsenic is one that will move, and if that's your concern, then you can, with an amendment, you can stop movement in your treated layer, and you're not necessarily going to have any effects in the layers below that has not been treated. So for most metals, migration isn't a concern in cases where they are a concern. The primary effect of your amendment will be on the surface. What we've seen in Leadville on experimental plots is you've seen increases in pH in the subsoil up to, and I just wrote up a paper on this, up to about 30 inches below the surface. It was about a 1 log unit increase in pH. So in certain cases, you will see some immobilization below the soil surface. That's not necessarily guaranteed.
Great. Okay. Mark, are you ready?
As ready as I'll ever be.
Okay.
This is all the extreme makeover, and so the ecological assessment here is it's more than just pretty on the surface.
Alongside
your data, Mark.
Alongside 45.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'll apologize a little bit because I'm not necessarily completely familiar with the exact slides, although I am familiar with all the information. The first slide that I'm looking at, which is 46, which is microbial function CO2 evolution, as I think was alluded to, my role in this was looking at the project after the revegetation had occurred and looking and seeing whether or not there's residual risk and or whether or not we could use any ecological risk type measures as evaluation of the performance of the amendment technology. And this thing just skipped back on me. Ah, there it is. You got a message, Harry. Mm-hmm. So this slide, looking at microbial function, that was one of the things we were interested in looking at, is soil functioning, with the idea that if the soil was functioning in the microbial community and the soil community as a whole is functioning, then the remedy should be sustainable, because everything that was happening, nutrient turnover, CO2 cycling, nitrogen cycling, all those things were occurring, and therefore the plants should be able to grow. And if that was growing and the soil was functioning, providing food, the whole ecosystem should be supported, and it should be a sustainable remedy. This slide just shows comparison to CO2 evolution in tailings, which did have microbial activity, but not certainly to the extent of the treated tailings or the control. And if there's something I'm missing on a couple of these slides, anyone, you can please jump in, a point that I'm overlooking. Earthworm survival. Using earthworms, I was teased a lot by Doc Smith up there about using earthworms, because there are very few earthworms at 10,000 feet in the Rockies, but earthworms are standard laboratory test organism for soil invertebrates. So we use them as such, as well as ultimately wanting to look at them for evaluation of availability of the metals, bioaccumulation. You can see from the slide that in the pure tailings, there was zero survivorship. Now, the first question anybody who does these kind of tests asks is, well, if they're in tailings, you know they're going to die because there's no food in there for them. And the structure is not very good, and the pH is bad. How do you know if anything other than largely these physical properties? And the reason we know that is because we did look at the pH as an issue and determined that pH was not the causative factor, and the fact that these earthworms died within about 48 to 72 hours and refused to burrow into the raw tailings. They just really were very unhappy, and they died very fast without even burrowing into the material. Downside of that from our perspective is you can't do accumulation if everything dies. So we had to wait until, you can't do relative accumulation to the primary material because nothing will live in it. And that creates a problem for documentation and looking at how much good you've accomplished. But on the survival side, we can do a lot. There, the amended tailings materials, you had effectively no mortality. These were 28-day studies. It's comparable to the upstream control and comparable to the laboratory control. That 89% is indistinguishable from either of the reference or the control. Biomass, if you look at the numbers there, the earthworms in the amended tailings are actually larger and significantly larger than the upstream control, and that has been interpreted basically as being the biosolids are extra food that's in there, and they can survive, and you've provided them with lots of good food that is the biosolids that they're actually working and turning into the soil, incorporating into the soil matrix, and they're doing that. There's a picture, I believe that's Doc Smith.
And Mike Zimmerman.
And Mike Zimmerman. And the background, I believe, is one, is part of Doc's property,
mm-hmm.
Which, as a side note, when we went in there, the I believe it was the first year that we had really good growth in there, Doc was just overwhelmed. He had managed to hay the area twice and had his cows grazing out in it, so I could do absolutely none of the things that I wanted to do on it, and he had to go find someplace else to sample. But he was very happy, and that's okay then. Plant diversity. Plant diversity is a key thing within restoring the area to something other than agricultural use. It is, unfortunately, a fairly difficult thing to do on your restoration area. And I don't mean difficult in that it is technically challenging. It is really more of a matter of there's a time element that you have to deal with. If you plant a single species for stabilization and then are waiting for natural colonization, it will occur, but it's a relatively slow process unless you have something that is drawing in seeds into the area for them to start growing and start reproducing. So largely, the first couple of years at least of doing these types of projects, your plant diversity is determined by what you planted in the first place. Now, there are some things that have been proposed in other restoration projects of planting seed bushes or fruit bushes or trees to try and bring in birds. That is, what's his name from Rutgers?
Steve Hendel.
Steve Hendel has promoted that, and it sounds like a really good idea. We haven't tried it as of yet, but birds will bring in a large number of seeds, of native seeds, and get those established in the area, and it would be a very inexpensive way of bringing in natural diversity and natural seed banks into your area. Again, the only downside with looking at plant diversity is making sure you're not misinterpreting your diversity that exists or lack of it, that it's just a function of time. You have to wait a while before you're really growing things that have been naturally seeded in the area.
Actually, that the slide with the picture shows that on some of the restored sites, we had wild asters as well as gooseberry and currant volunteering at the site.
And they do, especially on the periphery, they come in pretty quick. And we at Leadville, we could see around areas that we planted with perennial ryegrass and had a native seed mix adjacent to it, you could see the native seed mix moving in. But if you do a line transect or some of the standard ecology measures, you'll still come out and say that there's no diversity. And the inclination is to say, all right, well, it's not doing so well, when, in fact, it's those measures have absolutely nothing to do with that interpretation. And my only caution is, if you're looking at plant diversity on restoration projects, especially in the early years, make sure you're not misinterpreting your diversity data. This is the next slide. This is 50. This has a number of the species that were found. And as Sally pointed out, volunteers come in. They're there. You can find them. And it will happen, and it's going to happen. It's a question of how quickly it will happen. Slide 51, small mammals, near and dear to my heart. It is amazing how quickly, we didn't see it quite as dramatically at California Gulch on the upper Arkansas as we did on Jasper County, and as you see on the hillsides in Palmerton, and I believe a few other places. But within a very short period of time, once the vegetation is established, there's good vegetative cover, there are small mammals running rampant through your plots. Both in Jasper County and on Palmerton, when we've done small mammal trapping, we could hear the traps going off before we got out of our plot areas. The density and the trap success was so high. That appears to be because you have a very large food supply and not necessarily the predators in number that you might otherwise have. That's somewhat speculative, but one of the things we want to do with the small mammals, as this slide is indicating, is looking at accumulation and food chain transfer. We get the animals, we either do a whole body analysis or we can do specific organs. That is not done as commonly in Superfund because we want to get the accumulation data and for the whole body as an input to higher receptors. Because within the risk assessments, that's typically where people are focusing on. They want to, they're worried about the larger, more picturesque animals, the fox and hawks and things like that, and not necessarily as concerned about which rodents are running around. But the rodents are the means of transfer, one of the means of transfer into the food chain. One of the second bullet there, modeling to assess potential for food chain transfer, the primary risk being the direct soil ingestion. That is a big dilemma or a big issue to get resolved in the overall plan and evaluating success. As I believe Harry and Sally have mentioned, you're not changing the concentration within the soils dramatically. So if you're looking at within your exposure models to things within the food chain, the administered dose versus the absorbed dose, what they're actually exposed to versus what goes in their mouth and through their digestive system, those are going to be two very different things in an amended soil versus a non-amended soil because the availability has hopefully changed dramatically. But you need to get a way of determining what that actually is. That can go to using things like the earthworm as a surrogate for availability and calculating a bioavailability factor, or it may be using some kind of chemical extraction test and looking at differences, calibrating that with an accumulation study or something, but you need some kind of way of putting an availability modification on the direct soil ingestion term in the exposure models, or you won't change anything in your dose estimates. So that's a very important aspect of going through and doing these evaluations of food chain transfer.
If you go to 52, you'll see pretty pictures of this.
Yeah, I'm Harry's computer's slow.
Okay.
Okay, 52 is an illustration of this, of the food chain. If you have the soils, you get plants growing on it in the middle and earthworms or other soil invertebrates, and then they're consumed by higher wildlife, something like the white-footed mouse on the top. Not sure if that's a white-footed or a deer mouse, but basically the same animal. Just different species, which are primarily seed eaters and insectivores. And then on the bottom, something like a shrew, which is an insectivore, primary carnivore. Shrews are looked at a lot because they are small and have incredibly high metabolic rates. They basically have to eat almost constantly or they starve to death. Because of that,
that's a terrible thing that would be.
Their exposure rate is, and they never gain weight. Wish we could do that. They, because of their body size and their ingestion rate, they have a huge exposure term. and typically are one of the more sensitive dietary exposure pathways in ecological risk assessment because of that. Just a huge exposure term to a low body mass. Earthworms, as I said before, is typically the model for soil invertebrates. There are some soil invertebrates that accumulate more than earthworms. Probably not a great many, but a few, and it's specific to the area. And it's actually a relatively difficult thing to figure out once you have a really good understanding of the ecology of the area. So earthworms become a reasonably good model. Also, if you're dealing with soil ingestion, then things that eat earthworms tend to have high soil ingestion rates. That compounds that issue of the 100% availability of the soil ingestion term, because earthworms have a lot of soil in their gut. In fact, if you do it on a dry weight basis and a worm full of dirt, there's more dirt than there is earthworm. So that's just an issue that has to be dealt with in the interpretation of the data.
Yeah, in the Leadville case, though, with the mammals that you looked at and the different pathways, it would appear that what we did makes it okay for the mice and the shrews to live there.
Yes, and it did. I'm glad you said that, because that keyed me in. The accumulation was not dramatic in the earthworms once we did the amendments. You can see some accumulation. You expect that. There's going to be accumulation above pristine, if you can call something pristine. It's elevated metals, so you're going to have elevated accumulation. The issue is whether or not it's an acceptable amount of accumulation. When we looked at the stuff at Leadville, we saw exactly what we should in terms of things like zinc. There really wasn't much difference. It's a regulated element, terrestrially regulated very well. Really no difference between the animals. The only thing that you saw a dietary transfer, significant dietary transfer effect, was something like cadmium, where we did see a little bit more in the shrews than we did in the white-footed mice, which are lower on the food chain. And that's exactly what you should see, because cadmium does have a positive greater than one bioconcentration factor, although it's typically not very high, something on the order of 1, 2, maybe in rare instances as high as 10. Nothing like a PCBs or a DDT. But we saw exactly what we were supposed to see in terms of regulated elements being regulated, copper and zinc. Not, elements that do not readily food chain transfer, lead, being more on the low end of the food chain and not being transferred through the food chain. And the cadmium doing what it was supposed to do, but the total evaluation and going beyond even these organisms to putting the mouse data into the exposure to a hawk and assuming that it's getting all of its food off of these tailings deposits, we still came out and concluded that the exposure was not enough to, that we would conclude that there's a significant ecological risk.
And then on to the fish.
And I'm going to turn it back over to Harry, because he was more in tune with the fish assays. Thank you very much.
Okay, we also have a lot of questions in the queue, so we should try to finish this up.
All right. I'm going to ask Mark to hang around for the questions, because I'll bet there's a couple for him. All right, just quickly, re-entrainment, this is just a repeat. You know, there was concern about re-entrainment or the amended tailings back into the Arkansas River. What's going to happen? The following slide, 54, we did a re-entrainment study using just a standard ASTM soil lutriat kind of test. You can see the control was just normal soils. Treated tailings had almost perfect survival. The untreated tailings, dramatic difference. They were deadly to the little fathead minnows. This was a very convincing study for the stakeholders anyway. They were really happy to see this. Because, as I mentioned before, they voiced lots of concerns about the re-entrainment of the amended tailings back into the river. Okay, I think I switch back to Sally at this point for slide 55.
All that data and the discussion, that it was very nice to have Mark here with the point of that all was the sites look good, and despite looking good, they're not an attractive nuisance. And there's been very extensive monitoring on a number of the sites that we've treated, which should give you some confidence. And if you go now to the slide after that, which is number 56, when I was in Leadville last summer, we had, when we were doing the work there, put up informational kiosks about the mine tailings and what we were doing in bioavailability and in-situ restoration. And so the kiosks, when I was there last summer, were still there. But now instead of signs all about the remedial work, there were signs about what a subalpine ecosystem is. So it's, you go to some of these sites now that have been restored and we've done our job effectively enough that there's not a hint that we were ever there. And I think that's a good time to break for questions.
Thanks, Sally. My first question is, did you do any research in incorporating phytoremediation into the remediation projects?
We're talking here about metal sites, and I can tell you lots and lots about phytoremediation of metals. The plants that are good at, first of all, in order to take up lead on a site with phytoremediation, the big way that this has been done is by using a chelate. You have to ensure that there's no leakage from the system, you have to take the contaminated soil, put it on a non-permeable barrier, and then grow a very high biomass crop. This is not what we were trying to do here. Trying to grow corn that's 6 feet high in Leadville is a real challenge.
This is an immobilization technology
exactly,
that
yeah.
we were really focusing on to remove the bioavailability of the lead. And just generally, and actually Ellen's a phytoremediation person, there's only one plant out there that's commercially viable for picking or sucking up metals, and that's a Chinese brake fern for the most part.
And that's really just for arsenic.
And that's really just for arsenic, thank you.
And it's got a limited range where it can grow. And
mm-hmm.
And it's a subtropical species.
Yep.
So the phytoremediation part of it, limited application at this site.
Great. The next question is, please comment on the public perception of using biosolids as well as the agency acceptance of this methodology. How widely can these ideas be used? It might not be difficult to convince the public regulators to use biosolids in situations where there is 90,000 parts per million zinc. But what about situations where they're just barely exceeding standards?
That's an excellent question, and we run into that all the time. And we frequently go to public meetings and deal with exactly that, and it really depends on the part of the country. Up where Sally is, and I'll let her talk just briefly about it as well, but it's a commodity. It's actually kind of expensive up there because there's such high demand. There's a much larger acceptance of the material up there. For the most part, we try and use composts that have less odor. Odor seems to be the real trigger for people to get upset. So we try to use composted biosolids. And like I said, it largely depends on the area. I found that more agricultural areas that are used to manures and working around farmlands, people that are used to working in agricultural soils have no issues or very few issues with it whatsoever. And some parts of the country are absolutely phobic. They, you know, won't use it no matter how much science you can show them or share with them that it's not an issue or a problem. And even though there's never been any causal relationship ever been shown between biosolids and some kind of harm to humans at this point, you just can't overcome that public perception. So you just have to move on to something else and use manures or pulp and paper sludge or some other commodity. You know, you work your way around those kinds of issues.
One thing to say that's been very effective in the different sites, if you do a demonstration, so not a full scale, but if you start with a demonstration project, a pod study or small field plots, and you show what the different residuals can do, and you also show the cost of the residuals as a treatment versus conventional treatments. In Leadville, we had a lot of concern about the biosolids, and the biosolids that we got, the Class B from Denver, Doc Smith would be the first to tell you, boy, did that stuff stink. The pellets that we used later from Boston didn't stink. But when you see how effective it is, what you had people, and this is what people in Leadville said, when can we get more? You had Doc Smith calling up Denver Metro saying, could I please get some biosolids on my farm? And so a demonstration on a small scale with appropriate information and opportunities for people to ask questions can be a really excellent way to build trust in what you're doing and show the efficacy of what you're doing.
I was just at a public meeting just a few weeks ago for a 400-acre site just north of Pittsburgh. There were a lot of concern from the region about the whole issue of using composted biosolids at the site, or it was actually biosolids.
Yep.
And we came to this public meeting with community coordinators and all kinds of things, loaded for bear, ready for the questions, and they didn't ask question one about that. They had issues with other parts of a remedy, but they had absolutely no problem whatsoever with using biosolids for this huge abandoned steel mill site. So you never know, you know. So anyway, moving on.
Thank you. The next question is, does the use of residuals reduce contaminant concentrations to levels that are able to be redeveloped for use, for example, commercial or residential?
In general, even with a high, depending on what your level is to start with, if you're looking at totals, generally no. With the Leadville, you had 5,000 lead in the soil. You added biosolids at a 10% rate, so you brought that down 10,500 ppm.
So
you're looking at a change in bioavailable, but not necessarily enough of a dilution of total.
Yeah, and the other issue is using it around residential, the public perception is just, even if you could immobilize all the lead there or all the metals, people pretty much won't accept anything other than excavation for residential areas, I found. Commercial, possibly, for like landscaping, those kinds of things,
mm-hmm.
but I haven't tackled the residential areas myself.
Okay, thank you. The next question is, do you know of any examples where this type of cap has been installed on top of fly ash stabilized waste material?
I think they've done this on coal mine sites, and Lee Daniels at Virginia Tech would be a source of specific examples. I remember reading about this. I know Ohio State and Virginia Tech, Lee Daniels, and Ellen has contact information for Lee Daniels.
Yes, feel free to email me, and I will send you that information. Let me ask one more question here online, though we have plenty of questions, and we'll go to the phone line. What type of technique was used to determine the CO2 valuations?
You know, I used to know this by heart. Soil incubation, how did you do the CO2 incubations, Mark? Do you remember? I can look and figure it out.
I don't remember the exact technique. It was standard agricultural technique, incubation in a laboratory. I think it was at 20 degrees in the laboratory, and then you just capture the CO2 in a trap.
Yeah, I can look at the paper and tell you in a second if you want to go to the next question.
Okay, why don't we go to the phone line? Does anyone have a question on the phone line?
Hello?
Hello, go ahead.
It's a couple of questions. One is, for applying the biosolids, how are you determining the application rate? Are you using land application standards? Or is it an agronomic, like nutrient-based, or are you trying to achieve a certain water-holding capacity?
This is a really good question, and this is one of the things I have to tell you. It's not it's not a hard thing. There's not a great quantitative answer. A lot of the rates were based on what had been done at other sites. If you're looking at a site where you're concerned, if you use high rates of biosolids, we're not using agronomic rates, we're using reclamation rates. And those are generally 25 to 100 dry tons an acre. If groundwater and nitrogen moving to groundwater is a concern, you're going to want to use relatively low rates or mix the biosolids with something like a sawdust to make a higher C-to-N ratios to reduce your chances of nitrate moving. Okay, that's a big consideration. Depending on how disturbed or how contaminated the site is, it's been my way of gauging an application rate. So Leadville was pretty severe, pretty high rate. Jasper, not nearly as rough conditions, did 50 tons an acre there, 35 to 50 tons an acre. Palmerton, they also did a lower application rate. So coal mines, there are regs in Virginia and in Pennsylvania about amount of biosolids to use on a coal site. I think it's generally 35 dry tons, and if you use a compost material or add a sawdust to the mixture, you can increase the rate.
But like most technologies or innovative technologies, you'd want to do a treatability study to kind of narrow in on your amendment rate. It really depends on your performance measure that you're shooting for, you know, whether it be a leach test or some kind of risk measure. You know, we really focus in on it with treatability studies.
But if I understand right, you're just really trying to establish a vegetative system, and, you know, so you're just applying the biosolids along with the other materials, other amendments, to support that vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know you made the comment about increasing water holding capacity, but you aren't really blending the biosolids in with the existing materials on the site. You were just putting them on as basically a vegetative support layer.
No, we were mixing them in with the tailings on the site.
Oh, you did?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, and in Leadville, we tested differences in water holding. The CO2 evolution, by the way, you took moist soil, incubated it, and measured CO for 42 days and measured CO2 once per week during those 42 days. Using 20 grams of field moist soil, and gas was collected, and then the carbon was determined with a Hewlett-Packard gas chromatograph, if that's more information than you wanted.
And doing the treatability studies, I mean, these, when you add biosolids, like these Leadville soils, after the amendment was added, it passed TCLP, it passed multiple extraction procedure, and it passed SPLP, synthetic precipitation leach procedure. You throw the engineering test at it, it will pass it. It definitely immobilizes these metals to pass those tests.
And thanks for that. The other question I had was on long-term monitoring. You mentioned at the one site you were looking at Galena, but what other aspects of the program do you have for long-term monitoring of the effectiveness of the remedy?
This is a really, with Leadville, we've done the most extensive monitoring, and there the treatments were put in 97, and there was a large-scale monitoring done by Mike Zimmerman and Mike Holmes in the region last summer. So this is one of the things, I think that how long is long-term monitoring? There's been longer-term done at the Palmerton, Pennsylvania site. Some of this is agency funding dependent. And if the sites continue to look good, I don't know that there will be a big push to continue monitoring over time. Harry, would you know, Mark?
Unfortunately, it comes down to funding. Mark and I are both dying to go back to Leadville and Bunker and these places to do a whole nother round of sampling, but it's just prohibitive cost-wise, or not prohibitive, but we have to do a much downsized version of that. Mark, you want to?
Yeah, I would just throw in there that from the, the coal mining and other restoration projects, not things that are associated with hard rock, acid generation, and contaminated sites, that the answer, I believe, is, yeah, it's sustainable, it's going to hold the vegetative cover. The issue really is only a matter of whether or not acid generation is going to
increase over time
and undo what you did. That's the part that is sort of incomplete answer, as in, do we have a 20-year study in place to document that? And the answer is basically, no, we don't have a 20-year. As Harry and Sally mentioned, Palmerton has been there since, what, 80-something?
91, I think.
91. And by and large, that is still intact. There's some issues around the periphery but that's where the application was not complete. At least that's the handwriting on the wall right now.
Alright, thank you.
Thank you. Let's take one more question on the phone line and then we'll finish up the presentation.
I have two questions, please.
Sure.
One, was there, actually the question was handed to me, did non-refractory metals, the totals, increase using any type of lime kiln dust? And what is the long-term capacity of oxidized iron in reducing heavy metal leaching?
The sites that we were applying to had high enough metals that the lime kiln dust did not increase anything that we were concerned about. It was dilution. And then with the iron oxides, the goal is that you put down a material that's got a pretty reactive surface and that over time it gets more crystalline and that the metals that you've had stuck onto the surface get incorporated into the rock as it gets more solid. There have been lab studies with this using ferrohydrite. There's a manuscript by McBride that tried to artificially age ferrohydrite that had lead absorbed onto it and saw minimal release of ferrohydrite over time. So what you're hoping is you put down a reactive surface that's kind of like a gel. As it hardens over time, the contaminants that you want to trap are stuck in as part of the mineral matrix and get progressively less available over time. That is the science goal behind it, and time and better experimental tools will tell how effective that is.
Thanks, Sally. Let's finish up the presentation. We're on slide 57.
Okay. Hopefully you're convinced that this is an approach certainly worth considering. And some concerns like public acceptance have been brought out in a question. So here, just a little background or a little information on some potential concerns. One of the things that you're dealing with when you use an approach like this is you're going to a guy that's used to that pile in the back as a pain in his butt, something that's a waste that he has to deal with, or a residual. They're not used to necessarily thinking of this as a very desirable commodity. So there's not necessarily a fixed price for these materials or an infrastructure. I'm going to sneeze, excuse me. For purchasing these things. So you have to be willing to work with these generators. Generally, when they realize that, oh, you're serious, you really want this, you can start a great relationship, and it's something that can be good for both. Now, the other thing is on the public perception side, the perception that the residuals that you're using, the residuals, weight their waste, are they toxic? Are they going to hurt anything? And one of the things that people are concerned about is metals, for example, in biosolids. And if you go to slide number 58, one thing that's been great with the biosolids is with the federal regs on what you can discharge into a municipal sewer system, there are a lot of pretreatment regulations on metals, for example, as well as on organics. And so the different municipalities that make the biosolids have source control or pretreatment police. And this is some data from Chicago. And Chicago wanted to get the cadmium down and the lead down, so they got some of their police out there and did a very effective job. Look at the decrease in lead and cadmium concentration from 1980 to 2000. Chicago used to be famous for having very high cadmium biosolids. Now their biosolids have maybe 4 parts per million cadmium. If you look at Tacoma, an industrial city south of Seattle here, and their biosolids, they make a beautiful product called Tagro Classic. The metals in the Tagro are lower than the metals in competing compost product, Cedar Grove. They're lower than the metals in different animal manures. So because of pretreatment, there's a perception prior to pretreatment that biosolids had tons of metals. The reality is pretreatment has basically cleaned those up. If you go to the next slide, which I am trying, my computer is doing, this is a little timely, this one, number 59. Some of the residuals you can use, namely manures, they are not regulated. So there aren't requirements for pathogen destruction or pathogen reduction before these materials are land applied. So it's very doubtful at your sites that if you use a manure, anybody's going to go and plant a vegetable garden the next week. However, you do have things like E. coli in manures, and anybody that's tried to buy spinach in the supermarket in the last month has realized the ramifications of that. One of the things with biosolids is the pathogen concentration there is regulated, and the biosolids have to be treated to significantly reduce the pathogens before they're allowed to be land applied, and they can also be treated to eliminate the pathogens before they're land applied. So this is just something you should be aware of going into using residuals. And then go to 60, and I think 60 is 60 our last slide? No, we have 61. Residuals, what's very nice about these materials, we've shown you some really nasty cases and shown you how effective they can be at a less contaminated site. These can be a wonderful tool for you to use. And the last slide. Harry, you have anything to say?
Good job.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Sally and Mark and Harry, for the excellent presentation. It sparked a lot of interest, and we have a lot of questions. So let's quickly, and you should be on the last slide, slide 61, and if you hit the link to additional resources, you can see that where they have the, on the left column, there's a feedback. So if you want to fill out the comment form, that's where that will be. You'll see that's where today's presentation will be downloaded. And so feel free to fill out the comment section. We have a lot more questions, so we're going to try to get to them all in the time frame. But let's answer it up to the phone line, since I feel like I haven't been very fair on the phone line. If anyone has a question on the phone line, please ask.
Hi, I have a question. Do you have issues when you're treating the soils like up there at Leadville with the carbon to nitrogen ratio, and have you had to supplement the amendments with fertilizers?
Actually, one thing that's nice with the biosolids is you got your N, you got your P. You can be a little low on K, but you've also got all your micronutrients. And especially at the loading rates we were using, you didn't need to do any supplementing at all. You got tons of fertility there. Groundwater was monitored there by USGS, and they didn't see any peaks in nitrogen. If you go to a site where you have adequate rainfall and you put down 100 tons per acre of biosolids, you're going to see an increase in nitrate nitrogen for a limited time.
What about the CN ratio? You just wrote a paper on it, didn't you?
The CN ratio, we looked at if you could change the CN ratio, and that would get more native plants established, and it seems like if you take pure biosolids and mix them with some sawdust to get C to N to 20 to 1, you'll get greater plant diversity.
Okay, well thank you, Sally. Let's ask another question here. Land application of biosolids is often restricted due to heavy metal presence, which I think you've already answered, but they mentioned other contaminants such as estrogen in biosolids not mitigated during process. Is this a consideration during the work you're all doing?
There are federal regs on metal concentrations that are allowable in biosolids, and just about every municipality in the country will produce biosolids that have total metals that are well under what are considered exceptional quality in the EPA Part 503s. Each EPA region has a biosolids coordinator, and there are also biosolids organizations, local biosolids organizations like Northeast Biosolids Management Association, that can help you identify biosolids. But metals in biosolids were a big concern in 1980 and really are not going to restrict land application at all at this point. There are a host of materials that people are now concerned about, both from effluent from animal facilities and wastewater treatment plants, and now there's some data in the newest Environmental Science and Technology on these concentrations in biosolids. Some are endocrine disruptors like estrogens. There are a lot of studies going on now about what happens to these compounds when you land apply biosolids and manures, and I just got an email from a grad student that's working on nonylphenol, which is a detergent byproduct. These compounds, like estrogen and biosolids, comes primarily from birth control pills. And I'm sure many in the audience have had opportunity to be thankful for the existence of birth control pills. There has been studies by a guy in Canada, Ed Topp, who's seen that in an aerobic system, the estrogens and testosterones are broken down by soil microbes in about 24 hours. Dana, who's working with me on nonylphenols, which are endocrine disruptors from Mr. Clean and other detergents, they take about 15 days to break down. So we're seeing a lot of information coming out about those, and whereas these are a real concern in streams, we haven't seen any negative effects from these in soil systems and don't expect to.
Thanks, Sally. Do we have another question on the phone line? Okay, I have more questions here. Are you applying seed with applications of compost?
That's been done, and that can work really well with the biosolids. You get a lot of ammonia coming out initially, and that we tried to apply the seeds with the biosolids, and the ammonia was enough to kill the seeds, so you need to wait a couple of days.
Great, thank you. Do you feel that the soil amendments with residuals are a viable alternative for small urban sites where redevelopment will take place as compared to a fairly large rural mining site?
Particularly things like yard waste composts. A lot of municipalities are now diverting food waste from landfills and composting those. So in an urban area, you're not going to get away with using untreated residuals like Class B biosolids or manures. That's going to be a real tough sell. But your finished materials, like your composts, you're in an urban area, you'll have a source of these materials, and they're a very user-friendly product. So, yeah.
Thanks, Sally. Here's another question. How does a person or company find work applying this technology, material sales, installation service? Who specs the material blend or certifications required? I believe this person might have biosolids and wants to figure out how he could get into the business of applying them for remediation.
You know, I don't know. This
okay.
is early on. Harry, it's site-specific at this point. I would contact environmental consulting firms that work with EPA or other companies and say, look at what we've got, how can we work with you to use this stuff?
Yeah, is there a repository at technology at your office
no.
or your branch?
No.
No?
Not yet.
Oh, okay. I wish I had an answer for that question.
Yeah. Do we have any other questions on the phone line? Okay, I have another question here. How much of the contaminants such as lead are made available when arrowheads or cattails die and decompose?
If they don't have any in them to begin with, then very little. And that's one thing that's nice about that data that we showed.
Great. Any other questions on the phone line?
I got a question here.
Great. Go ahead.
When you were applying the biosolids, you were using a Terragator?
We did at Leadville.
And is that because you needed something that had really low ground pressure?
And it was also because Denver had one and they were willing to bring it.
good for the municipality cooperation.
Yep.
But you said you also used some sort of a ripper or something to incorporate it?
Mm-hmm.
Is that just a standard ripper on a bulldozer type
mm-hmm.
of?
Exactly, a three-tooth ripper on a, what was it, a D9? Tally?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry to get technical, but we're trying to do something like this in upstate New York, too, so I'm
good for you.
And we've got something with it's a residual that doesn't have a whole lot of strength, so I'm trying to trying to figure out how to get it out on the waste.
How wet is it?
Well, it's got a saturated water content in the neighborhood of like 65%.
Yep. You can put it down and let it on the surface, let it dry out, and then come back and work it.
No, I'm talking about the waste material that we're driving on.
Oh, okay.
Is at about, you know, potentially as high as 65%.
Oof.
55%. So that's why your talk about putting these in wetlands is of interest to me.
Yeah, you may be better off with a surface application, like a thrower.
Yeah, we did do small experimental plots using just standard ag equipment, a manure spreader. But as soon as it got a little bit wet in November last year, we buried it up to its axles. We were fine as long as it was dry.
Yeah, it may be that your application window is limited.
Oh yeah.
And also, if you're upstate New York, you're going to be buried in snow and ice pretty soon.
Well, there's the thought of letting it freeze over and putting it on top of the snow and ice.
And that's been done in other places.
Yeah, but then we've got, you know, the whole regulatory consideration of incorporating the biosolids so that,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's exposed out there.
I know Madison, their biosolids program, they are going to a Class A soil product because their application window is so limited.
In the interest of time, you might want to continue this conversation later, and I'm sure Sally would be happy to be a consultant.
Yeah, you just email me on this.
I would like to. I've got your webpage open right now, Sally.
Okay. Holding the cake.
I'll follow you.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. We have some more questions here online. When CDM conducts a reclamation project, we have to have soil specifications for the contractor to follow. Do you have a set of specifications for biosolids that can be used on a Superfund site?
I would, if you use biosolids that meet federal CFR regulations.
Okay. Such as percent of organic matter, CN ratio, microorganism content?
Well, the CFR, the Code of Federal Regs, will specify the vector attraction reduction, metal concentration, pathogen reduction. And most of your biosolids will have a fairly consistent, most of them will come out of anaerobic digesters and be relatively consistent in their quality.
Thank you. Let me ask one more question before I go back to the phone line. Are you getting the results desired, necessary, and acceptable time period for stakeholders involved?
Have been.
Well, it depends on how you look at it. It's never quick enough for stakeholders and regulatory authorities, but we get there. It's just the bigger issue is what can we use as a measure of success, given that the contaminant is still there in the soil. So it's whatever performance measure they can live with, whether it be an earthworm test or a TCLP or whatever. Sometimes it's quick. TCLP is quick. Some things take a little bit longer. If you're looking for diversity or percent cover, that might take a little longer.
Thank you. Do we have any more questions on the phone line?
Quick question on the Bunker Hill project. On the materials used, were you using the Class A, B biosolids, or were you using a composted biosolid?
In the wetland, a compost. We did work on the hillsides there with a Class B biosolid.
And the compost is significantly more expensive, is that correct?
Yep.
And what was it, why? Why did you use one place and another the other?
The compost were put directly into a wetland, so we wanted a really stable material that wouldn't shock the wetland with tons of nutrients. Use a Class B cake, you've got 6% N, very low carbon to nitrogen ratio. You're going to add so many nutrients to the wetland system that you're going to use up all the dissolved oxygen.
Kill everything.
Yeah.
And then the other question was on the wood ash.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose of that, was that as a liming agent or as a carbon source to help balance the carbon nitrogen?
So wood ash did have some carbon in it because you had incomplete combustion. It was also... But the carbon there is going to be like a truck coal, not going to be very readily available. So there, you're also going to have in the wood ash a fairly high mineral fraction. So it was a mineral source of pH neutralization. We also used woody log yard debris there, and that was our primary carbon source that was available.
Very good, thank you.
Any more questions on the phone line?
I think we're over time, and these guys want to leave.
Let me ask you, we have one more question here, so let me just ask this. The addition of persistent bioaccumulative toxins such as PAHs found in wood ash, for example, to aquatic ecosystems seems counterintuitive. How do you respond to such concerns?
I have to speak English for another 2 minutes here, and I will do my best. You know, wood ashes, I can't tell you about PAH concentrations in wood ash. I can tell you that the temperature that you burn the wood ash at and different wood ashes are burned at different temperatures will affect what type of materials you still have. Wood ash PAHs will be affected by combustion at different temperatures. If you are looking for a perfect answer, Diggin Hall is the closest thing, and the problems associated with Diggin Hall are pretty apparent. What we're talking about is an economically viable, very pragmatic approach that has its imperfections. And so when you're using something like a wood ash or a coal fly ash, you'll have maybe a little more boron than you want, or you may have a little higher concentration of some compound than you want. However, within these systems, you can use these materials and very effectively restore function to these systems. And that's a bit of a compromise that at the sites we've worked on, it seems to be very much worth it.
Thanks, Sally. We are out of time now. So Sally, Harry, and Mark, thank you again for a very informative presentation. Thank you for everyone listening. And I was just going to end with a comment that we got that I thought was very topical. It says, residuals are a great alternative to covering large tailing areas on the mega sites. Appropriate cover soil is often very difficult and expensive to find and requires disturbing another area as a bar source.
It's true.
Yep. So why don't we end with that? Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.